From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Just coming up for air on the down-ballot races, Justin Amash is leaving the 3rd Congressional District.
He basically just missed the filing deadline to run for re-election as a Libertarian in the seat. And when that deadline passed, he just sort of put out a tweet, yep, it's been a pleasure to serve. I'm not running for re-election.
Today, we meet contenders to replace him. Also, Donald Trump gained ground with auto industry workers in 2016. Did they get what they voted for?
They're not talking about steel tariffs. They're not talking about layoffs. They're not talking about specific policies. They're talking about an overall feeling of leadership.
And this hour, we're going to meet country singer Rachel Brooke.
I'm a very nostalgic person. I live in the same town that I was born in, really, because it means so much to me to have a feeling of home.
Those stories and more just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, how voters in Michigan's auto unions are feeling about the election.
What's interesting is while specific auto and labor issues are important, they describe an overall feeling, whether they're comfortable or uncomfortable.
Not to say these voters haven't been influenced by 2020's rough economic ride. Hang on, that story's coming up later in the show. But first, Michigan's 3rd Congressional District, which includes Grand Rapids, is our state's only open seat this election cycle. The seat's currently held by Libertarian Justin Amash. He caused a big stir when he left the Republican Party last year. It became clear that Amash would have a hard time holding on to his seat as an independent or as a Libertarian when he also lost the favor of his most important and moneyed supporters, the DeVos family. Now, the 3rd District is considered one to watch on election night, as Grand Rapids grows a more progressive, or at minimum, a more centrist voter base. Here to tell us about who's running and the hurdles they're looking at is Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer. Hey, Dustin.
Hey, April.
For starters, could you remind us how this seat opened up in the first place?
Well, yeah, as you said, this is the seat where Justin Amash is the congressman for now. He's been the congressman since 2010, and he's always been an interesting character in Michigan politics from even back in the day when he was in Lansing in the state legislature. He has always sort of gone his own way, and in the era of Donald Trump's Republican Party, Justin Amash had been a frequent critic of Donald Trump. And in fact, at one point, it was reported he said he didn't even vote for Donald Trump in 2016, went against him even as a Republican, finally called for Donald Trump's impeachment, and then left the party last summer. And Amash, it sort of took him a while to announce that he wasn't running for re-election. The order of events was that Amash actually explored a presidential run as Libertarian and announced that he was going to explore it and got a slick new website and a new photo on his Twitter bio. And then he said after looking at that, he decided, actually, I'm not going to run for president. I don't see a way that a Libertarian can win. Given everything that's happening with the pandemic, I couldn't really break through, he said. And while that all was happening, he basically just missed the filing deadline to run for re-election as a Libertarian in the seat. And when that deadline passed, he just sort of put out a tweet, yep, it's been a pleasure to serve this seat. I'm not running for re-election.
Wow. So who does that leave us with as the two major party candidates in the third?
So the two major party candidates are Hillary Skolton. She's running as the Democrat. She is a first-time candidate in Grand Rapids and anywhere else. And Peter Meyer, who's also a first-time candidate, and he's running as a Republican. Meyer got through a primary campaign against several Republicans who were vying for the seat. Skolton went, for the most part, unchallenged. There were a few Democrats who got in the race early on, but they never really matched her in terms of funding. And by the primary, they had dropped out.
Hillary Skolton has worked on some pretty interesting and high-profile civil rights cases in Grand Rapids. But I don't know if that outweighs the massive name recognition that Peter Meyer enjoys as part of the Meyer family, the grocery store Meyer family. How important is name recognition in this race?
Well, yeah, Peter Meyer's name is really, I mean, forget about yard signs. Meyer's name is on every sign at every highway exit and you know, in every neighborhood in this district and throughout the Midwest. So he has no problem getting his name out there. Hillary Skolton, her family's from West Michigan. There are people who know her throughout town and who know that name. But yeah, it's not the Meyer name at all. And I think, you know, name recognition is always important in any race. But I think when you're talking about a down ballot race, I mean, there's just going to be a lot of people who really haven't heard much about this race really at all. And so having a recognizable name that people go, oh, well, I don't know much about the 3rd Congressional District, but I know that name, that will make a difference.
You know, I just thought the Republican primary for the 3rd was so interesting. In a lot of other Republican pockets in the state, candidates run pretty far to the right, but this was one in which the candidates were running toward the center. Can you tell us more about how that worked out?
Well, first, there were a lot of candidates. They weren't all running toward the center. I mean, I'm thinking of Tom Norton, who was one of the candidates. He certainly wasn't running to the center. He was a pretty conservative, almost extreme candidate to some people. But the 3rd District, what's now the 3rd District, historically it had been the 5th District. This area, the area around Grand Rapids that includes Kent County, it's always been Republican for many, many years. I mean, the district's been held by Republicans since 1974, since the 1974 election, last time a Democrat won. But the Republicans who have held it have always been these moderate Republicans. I mean, Gerald Ford being the most famous one. He was well respected in the House. He was considered a moderate Republican. That's part of why Richard Nixon picked him to be his vice president, which then led to Gerald Ford becoming president. But even after Gerald Ford, names like Paul Henry, Vern Ehlers, who served right before Justin Amash, Ehlers was known for being someone who crossed the aisle quite a lot and caucused with the most moderate Republicans. Peter Meyer has really talked about that in his campaigning. He says, I want to be a Republican like Vern Ehlers, like Paul Henry. I want to serve the people of West Michigan and as a sort of moderate Republican. So he's really calling on that. And that's, I think, why you see people campaigning on that, because that history is there.
So now that we're past the primaries and into the general, would you say that Peter Meyer and Hillary Skolton are aiming at the middle?
With a lot of their communications, it sure seems that way. You know, I get flyers every day from both of these candidates. Hillary Skolton has emphasized her faith quite a lot throughout the campaign. It was her first ad. It's on all of her flyers. Legitimately, she's a person of faith. She's a Christian who grew up in West Michigan. That's important to a lot of voters here. It's clearly important to Hillary Skolton. Even as a Democrat, she's making that a key part of her campaign. And Peter Meyer just keeps talking about those other, you know, Republicans like Vern Ehlers and Paul Henry, just talking about West Michigan values. So they do both seem to be trying to communicate to, you know, to similar voters, voters who maybe were conservative, maybe have been conservative, but who are not necessarily happy with where Donald Trump has taken the party. I mean, you know, you could look at the 3rd District. Donald Trump won the district in 2016, but in Kent County, he won with the fewest number of votes of any Republican candidate in Kent County since the 1990s, going back all the way to Bob Dole. Hmm. So even though Trump was victorious in the county, he wasn't exactly exciting voters. And a lot of voters actually peeled off to the Libertarian Party. And one of them was a guy I talked to. His name's Jim Spicer. Jim Spicer, he called himself a lifelong Republican, but he ultimately voted against Donald Trump. He ultimately voted for the Libertarian candidate. He lives in Grand Rapids. But even though he voted Libertarian in 2016, even though he doesn't like Donald Trump, Jim Spicer told me he is going to vote for Peter Meyer.
He is kind of a personal responsibility candidate. And that's, I think that there needs to be more of that. He's not a nanny state kind of candidate. He's not a the government will take care of you, don't worry about it candidate.
So there's plenty to talk about in 2020. What kinds of issues are Meyer and Skolton talking about with Election Day just around the corner?
They're both releasing ads in the last week of the campaign talking about health care. Hillary Skolton has said a number of times health care is the number one issue that people ask her about when she's in the grocery store, and keeping healthcare affordable. So she's been emphasizing that and really trying to drive it as a point of difference between her and Meyer. She says that, so Peter Meyer signed a pledge early on in the campaign saying he would overturn Obamacare, if elected, he would help to try to overturn Obamacare. Hillary Skolton has used that as an opening to say he would take away the protections for people with pre-existing conditions, because without Obamacare, those protections wouldn't be in place. Peter Meyer comes back and says, no, hold on, wait a minute. I support protecting people with pre-existing conditions. I wouldn't eliminate that. And so that's something that I support. But they've sort of driven those things between them. Both are sort of fighting over that. Peter Meyer's latest ad says she's lying about that, that he will protect people with pre-existing conditions. So that's the thing that they seem to be fighting about most. That's the thing that they seem to be focusing on most.
Dustin, like you said, this district has leaned Republican for so long. And yet, I saw late last week the Cook Political Report decided to rate this as a toss-up district, and it's getting a lot of attention outside of the state because of that. Do you think this is really a toss-up race?
The polls seem to suggest it is, and the Cook Political Report says it leans Republican toss-up. If you look at 538, it favors Meyer slightly. But I think it's going to be really hard to predict the outcome of this race, because I think it could very well be close. But the other thing is that there are a ton of new voters in Kent County specifically, and most of the votes for this district come from Kent County. So there's been a ton of work in the past 2 years to register tens of thousands of new voters in Kent County. How those voters will vote, whether they'll even vote in the congressional race, could have a huge impact on this race. So I've been talking to some people. I talked to someone who lives in Grand Rapids and who works on the south side of town, works in communities, particularly in the Black community, talks to a lot of voters there. This is a place where many of those new voters, many people who may not have voted before, many people who may not have been registered before, are coming from. His name is Javin Hay, and he told me that one thing he's interested in this race is whether either of the candidates, Skolton or Meyer, are really speaking to people on that side of town. And here's what he said.
People might end up not voting, like, you know what I mean? I think there's like a lot of attention on the presidential debate, and I feel like if they aren't able to connect for real on their level, then they're going to be overlooked and people are not going to vote for them.
So I should say that Hay actually lives on the same side of town as Hillary Skolton. This is her neighborhood when he was talking to me. And I've seen her out campaigning this neighborhood. She certainly would say that she's trying to reach out to these voters. But at least at the time that I was speaking to Hay, a lot of people hadn't heard of her yet. So one of the big questions, you know, in this closely contested race is, you know, people are motivated to vote in the presidential race. Will they continue down the ballot and vote for these other candidates, even if they're not familiar with their name?
Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer coming to us from Grand Rapids. Dustin, thank you.
Thanks, April.
In just a moment, singer-songwriter Rachel Brooke talks about her latest country album and making a good sad song. That's next. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Bear. There's a place in the woods in Michigan, far from the lights of Detroit City, where old school cowgirls sing about getting through the hard years and why lonely hearts are pretty well armed for times like these. And that's where singer-songwriter Rachel Brooke's coming from.
Don't know what kept you from leaving.
Her music warms up your speakers with a feeling from years past when country music was full of wistful twang, maybe a dash of gothic charm, too. Her new album is The Loneliness in Me, and she joins us today from her home in Lovell. Rachel Brooke, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've talked to a bunch of musicians about the shutdown. I just wanted to start by asking what this time has been like for you.
Well, it's been kind of tough. I've been, when it first kind of happened, everything was put on pause. I was working on my record, and I was just about done. You know, I was just about finishing up with the mixing, and I had a few things to do, but it stopped. Everything stopped. So I kind of had to wait. I didn't know. I had no idea, like, if I was going to finish it, if things were going to open up a little bit so I could But yeah, it was pretty dark. But eventually it kind of started to loosen up a little bit and I got it done. And now it's kind of being released in the, and still the weird year of 2020. But, you know, just kind of making it work right now, you know?
Yeah. You know, there are some folks on the East Nashville scene who have had some success with doing online shows and online performances. But I mean, that's not the venue for everyone. Have you tried that at all, doing online live sets?
I have done a couple live streams here in my home. And it's, yeah, it's okay. Like, you know, it is a way that I can connect with people who maybe have never seen my music or been wanting to see my music again or whatever, you know? And so being able to do that was kind of cool, but it's just not the same, you know? It's totally, you know, like even though you're connecting with people, you can interact and talk. It's not like a real personal in the same room connection kind of thing, you know what I mean? And it's weird, but it works. You know, I've been adapting and I think a lot of musicians have been doing the same thing and we'll do what we got to do, you know?
Yeah, there's a certain kind of song set, too, that maybe lends itself a little bit more to a live room where you can feel the ambiance.
Yeah.
And you can sort of hear the pierce of the vocals a little
bit
more. Right,
and I like that better.
Yeah. It's like talking to someone you're dating over Zoom versus being in the room with them.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, can you describe the feel you were going for with the new record?
I wanted to, it's a couple different things. I wanted to have a lot of country songs, you know, like I'm a country person at heart. I love country music. I've pretty much what I like to write. So I wanted to just kind of make it a strong country record, but you know, I wanted to write some sad country songs, you know, like, I don't know, for me, country music is all about the sad songs. It's what speaks to me. It's what makes a country music song, I feel like a really good one. Not that all my songs are sad, because that's not, it's definitely not the truth, especially on this one. But I was really trying to, you know, yeah, write some good country sad songs. And
you were definitely going for it on this record.
Yes.
But even the sad songs like are not really, the title track, The Loneliness in Me, has a real bounce to it.
I'm a called Satan.
Yeah, that one is ironically, you know, on a whole record of sad songs, that one is not really too sad. It's, yeah, it's kind of like a little bit more humorous, I guess, and kind of more upbeat. And that song I'm really proud of, too.
In the video, you're sort of making reference to all the weirdness and isolation of this year. There's a vision of you watching television, getting information about viruses and everything else. And there's a lyric playing under it that says, I was prepared for any trouble that I've seen, thanks to the loneliness in me. Do you think that's true? Do you think that, you know, a life of heartache and heartbreak gets one ready for 2020?
Oh, well, you know, I don't know if there was anybody ever ready for 2020, honestly. But I do think that, at least for me, worrying about things in some ways, it's probably very unhealthy, but worrying about things kind of prepares me a little bit for anything that could happen, you know, like thinking about any possible scenario. It kind of like, all right, well, my brain is prepared for this, so I'll be all right if it ever happens, even though I hope it never does. You know, I don't know if it's, I'm pretty sure that's a common thing, but you know, it's probably something I should work on.
You co-wrote this record with your husband, right?
I did. Yeah, he was. He co-wrote most of the songs with me. There was a few that I had written by myself, and we've always been. I mean, he's a writer. I'm a writer. We've always been writing by ourselves. So this was both like this was a first for both of us to co-write.
How'd that go?
It was good. You know, I think it's taken us so long. You know, we've been married for 7 years. We've been together longer than that. And we've both been writers. And I think we knew for a long time that maybe it might be tough to get along, you know, but it did. It was actually really, it worked out well enough. I think it's been like, okay, we're comfortable enough with each other. We're not going to be mad at the other person for, you know, not liking the other one's ideas and stuff, you know. So we made it work. And, you know, now it's like my go-to method. It's like I loved it so much. I loved working with him. You know, he's got such great ideas. And, you know, we can kind of balance each other out, too, on some of the stuff.
I'm a worried man.
If you're just joining us, my guest is singer-songwriter Rachel Brooke. She has a new album titled The Loneliness in Me.
Never come to understand how in the morning as the sun came up, I found it. It's still in my hand. God damn, I found it. It's still in my hand.
You grew up in Lovell, not too far from Grayling, for folks who know where that is, and the beautiful Hartwick Pines State Park, which I think used to be an old logging camp.
Oh, yeah. Hartwick Pines is, yes. Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah.
What kind of musical inspirations? I mean, I imagine that's Picker's country. I mean, is there much of an old-timey scene there?
In this area, not really, but there seems to be a lot of a folk kind of scene here. And, you know, new singer-songwriter kind of stuff. But as far as old-time stuff, there's not really a lot. You know, I played with my dad. He played bluegrass, but, even that was kind of a newer, you know, 1970s and you know, kind of stuff. So there isn't. And then that's been kind of tough, being able to connect with other old-time and, you know, kind of country musicians. But there are few. It's just you kind of got to know where to look, really. You know, there's a lot of old, like backwoods kind of like jam sessions, but you got to know when they are and, you know, that kind of stuff, but not too much.
What kind of music did you play with your dad?
I play bluegrass with my dad. My dad was a banjo player, and he started, you know, playing really young. And then when I got to be a little bit older, I started playing with him. And he's, we played bluegrass and country music until he just passed away last summer.
I'm sorry to hear that. Was he the one who taught you guitar?
Yes, he was. I started showing, like, an interest when I was, like, 13 or 14, you know, and he gave me my first guitar to play on. And then I feel like I really started learning with him when I was about 18. I really started to play the country bluegrass stuff. I mean, he like threw me on a stage. I didn't even know what I was doing. I knew how to play like 3 or 4 chords. I was like, okay, I guess I can, you know, I can do this. But I put everything I know to him. You know, he taught me everything. He taught me, you know, everything I know.
Yeah. It can be a lot growing up with another musician in the family. I mean, for some people, that makes for a very natural learning environment. And for others, you know, people kind of feel like they have to find their own thing as well. Was there stuff that, I mean, your style is not inherently bluegrass, but do you think that there are things that carry through to the music you're writing now from the time you spent playing with him?
I think so. I think that everything I write, it comes from my soul. You know, I'm a very like nostalgic person, like just because, you know, like I live in the same town I grew that I was born in, really, because it means so much to me to have a feeling of home. And so I think that comes through a lot in my music. You know, I think about the past a lot with my dad, and I think it just kind of naturally just flows in there. You know, it kind of just comes in just because I love it. You know, I loved him. I loved all the times that we spent together. And I think that, you know, in this record and then the future ones, I'll probably have some elements of that home and bluegrassy kind of feel that always kind of runs through, just because I can't help that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. When you listen to bluegrass these days, what do you listen to?
I listen to the old stuff, really. You know, I like the Osborne Brothers a lot. They're probably my favorite. And then, like, I like Jimmy Martin. Mm-hmm. But I know that Billy Strings, he's like a new one, you know, like a newer bluegrass picker. I really like his stuff a lot. Yeah, I tend to go for, like, the older bluegrass. I think it's just, like, the classic stuff, you know. It's the kind of stuff I want to hear.
You know, not too long ago, you posted a bunch of videos of cover songs. They were all shot in black and white, and they were all really old songs, like Hank Williams and older Willie Nelson stuff. I was wondering what sparked that series for you.
Well, that was actually during, you know, like the lockdown and stuff. I felt like that kind of music is probably, you know, like Hank Williams is probably my all-time favorite singer and songwriter, and also Willie Nelson too. You know, they just speak to me, you know, and during the lockdown, I was just like, I got to do something here. I got to stay somehow connected, and just being able to play those songs, you know, and maybe put them out there for people to hear, you know, it's fun. It's doing what I love to do. You know, it's like being able to kind of put my own feel into a song that I love, you know, Hank Williams and I love that song, Willie Nelson, Are You Sure? That's the one that I put on YouTube. And it's just so good. They're just so sad, you know, and I just love them.
Look around you. Look down the bar from you at the faces that you see. Are you sure this is where to be?
You moved around a lot, and you're living in Lovell these days. I just wonder what you're finding in a small town setting right now that maybe you didn't in bigger cities like Nashville or LA.
Well, there's some, you know, there are a lot of like benefits to living out in the woods in the middle of nowhere. You know, that's really quiet. You can see like the stars, you know, you can see, you know, you can go outside at night and you don't hear anything except for like coyotes. And that's the truth. I'll walk out every night and I'll hear the coyotes like yapping, you know? And to me, yeah, you don't get that kind of stuff in big cities, but there's also things that I miss, you know. I was living down near Detroit for a couple years. I spent a lot of time in Detroit playing. You know, you could go out any night of the week and play music. Up here, no. You can't. And there's not that many people to really, you know, play with. And, you know, I'm kind of both. I can be one day, I can be a complete, like, introvert. And I don't want to see or do anything or be around anybody. And I just want to be by myself. But other days, I miss being able to just call somebody up and say, hey, let's go play. Let's go like jam, or, you know, hey, I'm going to be at this place tonight. What are you doing? Kind of stuff. And so, you know, there's a lot of, you know, pros and cons. It makes me actually think of this song. I love this song by Jonathan Richman. And this is another one that I actually want to cover, but it's called City Versus Country by Jonathan Richman. And it is so, it's like, it speaks to my heart, like so perfect. It's such a pretty song.
I want to live close to downtown, to be near my friends. I want to be close to them, but still be out by the trees in the wind. Heaven both will be hard to find, I'm sure. But then, ain't that the way of the world? I want the city, but I want the country.
Folks who know your catalog a little bit won't be too surprised to hear you mention Jonathan Richman. There's a song that I want to play just a little bit of off your album, A Killer's Dream. It's called The Blackbird.
There's a big blackbird high up in
you talk a little bit about the more goth side of your songwriting and what need that fills for you?
Well, you know, I don't really know how it really started. I think it was just, you know, listening to Hank Williams and I love the Carter Family, and their songs are they're just so simple, but they sing about a lot of darker things, you know, but they sing about it with such ease. So back then, I think I was just kind of really into that kind of music of kind of like the darker stuff. And I was also really listening to like jazz and blues at that kind. And they all sing about that kind of stuff. And to me, I just fell in love with it. And because I was listening to all those kinds of things, I started to create those kinds of songs.
Well, Rachel Brooke, we really appreciate your talking to us. The new record is The Loneliness in Me. We're looking forward to a proper tour when things open up a bit more.
Oh, yes, me too. I'm hoping, you know, that in the spring, summertime, I'll be able to travel and move around. And yeah, I hope that maybe I'll see you guys out there.
Arts and culture coverage on Stateside is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Like your picture. Your love has faded just the same. But I'm holding. You know, Donald Trump found a very sympathetic pool of voters among some Michigan auto workers in 2016. We'll hear about what union workers are looking for this time around after a short break. Stay with us. I'm April Baer. In 2016, working class voters in the Midwest played a big role in getting Donald Trump to the White House. While his margin of victory in Michigan was really narrow, I mean, he won by fewer than 11,000 votes, many analysts pointed to Hillary Clinton's inability to connect with blue-collar working-class people in the Rust Belt as being part of her downfall. So this year, there are a lot of people watching how these workers will vote in states like Michigan and Ohio and Pennsylvania. Phoebe Wall Howard is the automotive reporter at the Detroit Free Press, and she recently spoke with some voters who were also in the auto unions. Phoebe Wall Howard, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So how big a voting block are union workers in Michigan these days?
Approximately 15% of the folks in Michigan are union affiliated. But when we're talking about auto affiliated, that's over 300,000 people and active voters. And what we're looking at in 2020 is fewer people staying home. In 2016, triple the number of union voters stayed home. They did not choose Hillary Clinton. They did not choose Donald Trump. We're not seeing that same activity this year.
I mean, labor unions are usually seen as a loyally Democratic voting bloc, but it obviously looks different within the ranks. What divisions did you find when you were talking to people when it came to their presidential preferences?
One thing that seems little known in the UAW voting bloc is that the Republican candidate generally owns a solid one-third of the vote. So Donald Trump won 31%, but his predecessors actually did just as well, Mitt Romney and John McCain in 2012 and 2008. So again, union voters generally cast one-third of their vote for Republicans consistently. And so the difference is that triple the number of voters that sit out usually with each presidential sat out in 2016. Fewer people cast for Hillary Clinton than would have cast for the Democrat in the past. So some people have said, wait, Hillary Clinton won more than 60% of the union vote. That's very, very impressive. But actually, no, it's consistent. She won less of the union vote than her predecessors. And that's what Joe Biden has to close in this election cycle.
Right. So you've been out there. It sounds like from your article that you talked to some of those people who did sit out. What are those voters thinking and talking about these days?
It seems that they're just, first of all, it's very interesting, the number of people who didn't feel it was necessary to engage earlier, and they're working not just to register people and register themselves. When you meet union workers who are in their 20s and have not been registered or active and older, So they're very, very engaged this time. What's interesting is while specific auto and labor issues are important, they describe an overall feeling, whether they're comfortable or uncomfortable. So supporters of Donald Trump describe a feeling that he projects. And on the other side of the aisle, a feeling that Joe Biden projects, that they believe Biden, for example, supports working people, not necessarily either side itemizing issues. They're not talking about steel tariffs. They're not talking about layoffs. They're not talking about specific policies. They're talking about an overall feeling of leadership, which is a little bit different than years past.
Wow. That's, I mean, it sounds like a mixed blessing. On the one hand, it's, you know, it may not mean that issues voting is a thing among this bloc, but at the same time, it seems like it's awfully ephemeral and could possibly be subject to change.
This is a highly dynamic situation. The issue is absolutely voter turnout. And what we're seeing with union workers this cycle is passion on both sides of the aisle. Absolutely. So it is a matter of, again, when you're talking, you know, I cover the budget of Ford Motor Company, and the tariff issue was huge in terms of all the automakers took a hard hit with steel tariffs. So, you know, you have the auto companies having a lot of pain in recent years, but that's not something either side looks at in terms of workers. They don't. And what else is interesting is the idea of not sitting home on the presidential. It is a strange thing to think the number of people who cast votes in 2016 that simply left the presidential box empty. And that was a lot of union workers. They didn't feel that either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump would represent them. This year, the Trump supporters are stronger than ever. I could not find personally anyone who had fallen away from him. They felt strong about their initial vote and plan to stay with him. I also met a number of people who were registering for the first time because they were inspired to engage, and those people said they were voting for Joe Biden. They felt comfortable and strong about that.
Phoebe Wall Howard is an automotive reporter at the Detroit Free Press. You can read her article on auto union voters at the Free Press's website. Phoebe, thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Daniel Howes, business columnist with the Detroit News, has also been thinking a lot about auto industry politics this election season. And he joins us now. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So the industry and candidates' rhetoric around it just felt like all this played a much bigger role in 2016.
No, I think you're right. You know, that's a really fair point. And I think there's probably a lot of different reasons for that. One of which is, I think Trump saw that this was a leg up for him in the industrial Midwest, and his people, I think, correctly identified that that was the gateway to the White House, and they were right. Now he's got a record, and some of the things that he promised, insofar as the auto industry are concerned, didn't necessarily come true or didn't come true in the way in which he certainly perceived it to be.
Do you think that auto workers feel that Trump has been able to deliver on promises that he made them in 2016?
Well, it depends on what auto worker you are. If you're in the Mahoning Valley in Northeast Ohio, the site of the General Motors Lordstown plant, where he went famously in 2017, I believe it was, and said, "Don't sell your homes. Manufacturing jobs are coming back." Mm. It's just not true. Lordstown has, since that time, when it was running three shifts, it's now gone. It's closed, sold off to an electric truck startup, which is actually, as we speak, is bringing to production an electric pickup truck that will largely be sold to commercial customers. But the plant will employ a lot fewer people than certainly it did in its heyday.
Sure. And this is a part of the region that has seen a lot of knows some decline. they've seen this movie before.
Yeah, they have, but there are bright spots. Certainly within the Detroit-based auto industry, there's been a lot of investment, and particularly in Southeast Michigan, and even in Detroit. I mean, where you're getting your first new auto plant in 30 years with Fiat Chrysler. another Jeep plant, the Detroit Hamtramck, GM's plant down there, which was also on the closure list along with Lordstown in November of 2018, has got a new life and will be they're calling it Factory Zero. It's going to be the kind of the marquee electric vehicle plant for General Motors in the United States. And you've got another one up in Lake Orion that has been operating for some time. So there's a lot of positive news, I think, in part. And I think you could make the argument, and I'm sure Trump supporters would make the argument, that the reason GM, Ford, and Chrysler are investing particularly in their home state is because of the politics of the president. But I would say that that's a byproduct, probably. These companies understand the importance of building product in the United States to sell to Americans. They know that it's problematic, particularly trying to bring product in from China is very problematic. And the only manufacturer that does that at this time is GM, and it's only one product, if I'm not mistaken, at this point. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think they understand that as well.
Reading what you wrote about this, there was a guy that you talked to, Terry Bowman, who called Trump the blue-collar billionaire. We could talk for a long time about the veracity of either part of that title, but just looking at it from his perspective, you know, Trump was born into money in New York City, but he has been able to connect with working-class people like Terry. What is it you heard from the voters who are sticking with Trump about why that message still resonates and why he gets them?
Well, I mean, I think you have to assume or accept the fact that he does get them and that it's not just a political vehicle on his part. And I think he has tapped into a notion of disaffection, disappointment in the working middle class over what has happened over the years. I think you hear, we've seen it in emails and comments to the newspaper for years. They blame all sorts of things on their what has happened to them, what has happened to the jobs, what is, you know, that they've gone overseas. They very seldom will talk about you know, investment decisions and product decisions that the people that they work for made, because in a lot of cases, you know, in the case of success of Japanese manufacturers in the United States, they were building a better product for a long time, and that kind of built on itself. Now, Detroit is in a very different place today, and I think that speaks to the point you made at the top, which is this isn't so much of an issue today because we are on the end of the longest period of growth and profitability we've seen since the 1960s here. And remember that in 2016, when Trump was running against Hillary Clinton, she was associated clearly with Obama, the Obama administration, the controversy surrounding the bailout and bankruptcies of the auto companies and a couple of suppliers. That was a club that they could conveniently wield to beat against anybody, frankly, who was associated with it. That's now ancient history in a lot of ways, even though Joe Biden was part of that administration. I think most people look at this in a fair-minded way and realize that it was the president didn't have another choice, frankly, and I think had he been a Republican, he would have done the same thing.
Let's talk a little bit more about the economic picture and how it's been shaped by the pandemic. It's hard to imagine, like, which would be a bigger issue for folks in the Detroit metro area right now. Mm-hmm. What can we say about how the pandemic and the pandemic shutdown have affected voters who are affiliated with auto unions?
That's a great question. I mean, you know, there were people that didn't work for several months as a result of that. And there was a lot of concern about going back. It was a real problem, frankly, for the union. They were trying to manage their way through it. They had people who were complaining about, there were stories that we heard of people that were complaining about various plants that were not maintaining certain kind of protocols. And then they would go across the street to the union hall and they'd hang out and drink beer and sit on the picnic table right next to each other without masks on. And the union leadership, as the story goes, would say, "You guys aren't helping us here. We're trying to work with the manufacturers to make sure these workplaces are clean and sanitized. And then you're going over and hanging out with your buddies over at the union hall. That just doesn't help us. We need to model good behavior." And I think that the car companies deserve a lot of credit for taking this seriously, of getting their hands around the situation and getting back to production. This week, as it happens, is earnings week, and we're going to get to see, this is a pure pandemic quarter, and I think you're going to see that these manufacturers have come roaring back and are going to report some very solid numbers.
You know, there's something we haven't really addressed, and that's how the auto companies themselves are feeling about this race. Back in April, the UAW was backing Biden because mm-hmm. he supports collective bargaining and workplace mm-hmm. protections and healthcare. But the automakers themselves weren't so sure. And I saw a Bloomberg report where Congresswoman Debbie Dingell of Michigan said the industry is more divided than she's seen it in her lifetime. Mm-hmm. What do you make of the fact that there is this division right now, that some of the automakers feel like they'd rather, at least they know what they're getting with Trump, and others feel like Biden is the guy who's going to get them through this?
Well, I think it depends on what you mean by divided. And I would drill down with Debbie if she were on here and say, what do you mean by that? GM and Ford, to use two examples, are on different sides of the whole emissions policy. Ford has allied themselves with California and some other foreign manufacturers and said, okay, we'll cut a deal that is less than what the Obama numbers were, but more than the Trump numbers were. But I think there's a different calculus here. And I think that part of that calculus, at least for General Motors, is we have to deal with the president as he is. So, and it reminds me of what Sergio Marchionne said when in the early days of Trump, and he got exasperated with some reporters, and he said, look, he's the president, we adjust. That's how it works. And I think if you sat down and you talked to them on background or off the record, they would tell you that. Yes, there's things we don't like. There are policies. I mean, the whole pandemic and the Defense Production Act, I could talk to you about that for an hour, about the games that the administration played with General Motors particularly. Just maddening things that they did. But he is the president, and the administration is what it is. And I think if Joe Biden wins and becomes the next president, they will adjust, and they will probably see more clarity, I would think, on emissions. They would not be trying to roll back the Obama targets, most likely. But there's a whole host of issues, and these companies have a whole operations that do nothing but manage government affairs.
What are the experts telling us about how much of the labor vote in Michigan would have to go for either candidate to really swing the race?
That's a great question. And generally, I would think it's going to be split. Mm-hmm. And this has been the case, by the way, with particularly with the United Auto Workers for a very long time. The rank and file maybe see the world very differently than their leadership does. And their leadership is reliably democratic, reliably liberal in terms of the causes that it supports openly. But I think the leadership knows that there's a lot of its members that are not and don't live their lives that way and don't look at the world that way. And those are the people that were the Reagan Democrats in the 80s. They then voted for Bill Clinton. Many of them supported Trump over Clinton in 16.
Daniel, as someone who covers the automotive industry, which is so core to Michigan's identity, mm-hmm. do you think the candidates are paying enough attention to it this go-round?
You know, I think because we have the pandemic and we have the president's record, and the industry is in large part doing very well financially, and was part of the solution early on in the pandemic. I have to be honest with you, I was very proud of those companies and the way in which their management and their teams coalesced very quickly to build PPE, to build ventilators, to work with ventilator producers, to scale up and produce more ventilators for the country, and frankly, I think for other parts of the world. They're not a problem right now, and it's not a really bad story. I think there are bigger issues, frankly, than the auto industry at this point in this campaign and in this election.
Daniel House is an associate business editor at the Detroit News and a columnist who covers the automotive industry extensively. Dan, it's good to hear from you. Just one more week of this.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.